Good afternoon, everyone. Bonsoir. Je suis Hugo Melgar Quiñones, directeur du McGill Institute pour la Sécurité Alimentaire Mondiale. Bienvenue à la 8e conférence McGill sur la Sécurité Alimentaire Mondiale. Le thème cette année est « Défis actuels et futurs pour la sécurité alimentaire durable ». Welcome, everyone. My name is Hugo Melgar Quiñones. I am the director of the McGill Institute for Global Food Security. Welcome to all of you to the 8th McGill Conference on Global Food Security. The theme of this year's conference is current and future challenges for sustainable food security. In the next hours and tomorrow, we'll have the opportunity to embark in a very enthusiastic, I hope, proactive, exciting, interesting discussion about how to make our world a world of sustainable food security. Tonight, we are honored to have a very distinguished group of participants and speakers who will share this podium in this public lecture and tomorrow throughout the day in our different sessions. We have several colleagues who work here in Montreal, in the McGill downtown campus, in the McDonald campus in Saint-Anne-de-Bellevue. We have colleagues who visit us from the United States and as far afield as India, Nigeria, in other countries. I welcome several of my colleagues in this university and other academic centers and all of our visitors. I would like to thank the sponsors and donors who support the Global Food Security Conference. Your support helps us to continue bringing you this type of conferences. In particular, I would like to thank the Syngenta Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture, and we welcome Laurie Goodwin from Syngenta Canada as one of our guests. I would also like to welcome Mr. Petro Chacon from the Inter-American Institute for Cooperation in Agriculture. Thank you very much for your support and the support of others in bringing into this room many, many very young people, undergraduate and graduate students, who will make the best use of this opportunity to learn from your experience, from your work. I would also like to thank the donors who sponsor this student passes. This is a wonderful way for students, again, who might not have otherwise the opportunity, the ability to attend the conference. I'm very grateful to our audience. We are pleased that you can join us, and we welcome you. I would like to officially open this annual Global Food Security Conference at McGill University. As I mentioned before, I am very fortunate to share with you that this year we have several outstanding speakers in our program. In addition to the 4 sessions that we will have here tomorrow, you will be hearing from our new dean, Professor Anya Geitman, in the Faculty of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences, from Dr. David Bergen-Vinson, Director General in the International Crop Research Institute for the Semi-Arid Tropics, ICRISAT, who will deliver the keynote address tomorrow. We will welcome also Dr. Audia Barnett, who is the representative to Canada at the Inter-American Institute for Cooperation in Agriculture, who will deliver the conference wrap-up the day of tomorrow. Tonight, we are honored, we are very happy, we are very excited and thankful to have President Kanayo Nuanse, President of International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD, who will present tonight's public lecture keynote address. I want to thank Professor Chandra Madramutu for your help in getting our public lecturer as well as our keynote speaker for tomorrow to Montreal and to McGill. Thank you very much. Allow me to introduce you Professor Anya Guidman, the Dean of the Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences, who will introduce our keynote speaker. Professor Guidman is a professor and dean in our faculty and joined McGill just recently. From 2001 to 2015, Professor Guidman was a professor at the Department of Biological Sciences of the University of Montreal and a scientist at the Institute de Recherche en Biologie Végétale. Excuse me for my accent. She obtained her PhD in 1997 from the University of Siena, Italy, following undergraduate and graduate studies at the University of Constance in Germany, at Oregon University in the United States, and Stockholm University in Sweden. Between 97 and 2001, Professor Guidman performed postdoctoral research at the University of Laval in Quebec and at the University of Wageningen in the Netherlands. She currently serves as president of the Canadian Society of Plant Biologists and as past president of the Microscopical Society of Canada. She is the vice president of the International Association of Plant Sexual Reproduction Research. She serves on the editorial boards of multiple scientific journals, including Plant Physiology. Dr. Guidman leads an interdisciplinary team of cell biologists and mechanical engineers, and her research program focuses on the biomechanical principles governing plant development and reproduction. Please join me in welcoming Dean Guidman.
Bonsoir. Je suis enchantée d'être ici. Comme M. Melgar Quignonès disait, j'ai joint McGill seulement il y a quelques semaines. I'm delighted to be here. I indeed joined McGill University and the McDonald campus only a few weeks ago, and this is the first time I have the privilege to be at this conference, which is, of course, the eighth in a series that was set up by Hugo and the former dean, Chandra Madramutu, and I think they have to be commended for this immense effort to set up. I guess I just killed my own microphone. Can you still hear me? Yes. To set up this meeting. This is one of our most important outreach activities, and it embraces all research, education, as well as outreach to the general public. And it is my great pleasure now to introduce Kanayo Nuanse. Kanayo Nuanse is the president of the International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD. He's a Nigerian national and earned his Bachelor of Science degree in agricultural science from the University of Ibadan in Nigeria in 1971. He obtained a doctorate in agricultural entomology from Kansas State University in 1975 and has been advocate and leader with a keen understanding of complex developmental issues. He has 35 years of experience across three continents. He has focused on poverty reduction through agriculture, rural development, and research. Before he became vice president and then president of IFAD, he was the director general of the Africa Rice Center for a decade. He was instrumental when he was there in introducing and promoting, for example, New Rice for Africa, NERICA, a high-yield, drought- and pest-resistant rice variety developed specifically for the African landscape. He transformed the center from a West African to an Africa-wide organization with a global reputation for excellence. President Nuanse is now in his second term at IFAD. Under his guidance, IFAD has stepped up its advocacy efforts to ensure that agriculture is a central part of the international developmental agenda. Governments recognize concerns of smallholder farmers and other poor rural people. During Nwanze's tenure, IFAD has increased the number of outposted country program managers and country offices. And through that, IFAD has become a valued and results-focused international developmental partner. Professor Nwanze has received numerous honors and awards from governments and international institutions. For example, he is commander of the National Order of Merit of Côte d'Ivoire. He is officer of the National Order of Benin and National Order of Agricultural Merit of France. Most importantly for us, however, Dr. Nwanze has obtained a Doctor of Science as honoris causa from McGill University in 2012, and that is our great pleasure to now receive him here and give his keynote lecture. Please join me in thanking Dr. Nwanze for coming to McGill.
Merci, Madame le Professeur Anya Gaitman, doyenne de la Faculté de l'Agriculture et des Sciences Environnementales. Docteur Hugo Melga Quinones, Professeur Madame Moutou, chers collègues, Mesdames et Messieurs, now I shall revert to a language where I am more at ease. It is indeed a pleasure for me to be back here in McGill. The topic of food and nutrition security is central to my work, and it's dear to my heart. And it's always an honor to speak today as an alumnus of McGill University at what I believe is a world-renowned Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences. So I'm here today to share what I have learned in my years as a development practitioner, but I believe learning is a two-way process. Sharing knowledge. Knowledge is one of very few things that I know that can only grow when they are shared. If you keep it to yourself, it doesn't grow. When you share it, it grows. That's my lesson number one. So I'm here to learn from you as well. To learn your thoughts and ideas during the question and answer session later, which I believe we will have. So let me keep watch on how much time I speak. I may get carried away. This is a very passionate topic. Norman Borlaug, the plant biologist known as the father of the Green Revolution and the man who saved a million lives, he once said, and I quote, it's a sad fact that on this earth, at this late date, there are still two worlds, the privileged world and the forgotten world. That was in 1970, almost half a century ago. Yet today, this sad fact remains. Now, if we are true and sincere in our ambition to rid the world of hunger and undernutrition, then we must start with this forgotten, invisible world and the people who live in it. Who are they? They are the women and the men and the children who live in the rural areas of the developing world, the developing countries. Although they account for only 40% of the world's population, they represent an overwhelming 75% of the world's poorest and hungriest. They are deprived, they are underprivileged, and they are very hard to reach because they live in remote areas away from the world's media, political leaders, and centers. They are all too often easy to forget until their quiet problems turn into crisis and their crises become our worries for fear of what it will do to us. Only then do we listen and take action. Let's take migration, the big issue about migration today. Today we are seeing the biggest movement of people ever since the Second World War. What causes people to migrate? Conflict? Yes, certainly. But also hunger, poverty, deprivation, inequality, poor governance, persistent indignity, and lack of opportunity. These are the conditions that have forced millions of rural people to leave their homes year after year, decade after decade. Who in their right mind, who in their right mind, which parent in their right mind will put a child on a boat to travel the seas because the seas and oceans have become safer than the land? Who in their right mind will do that? Until their numbers swelled with people fleeing from the horrors in Syria and elsewhere, until they started drowning in large enough numbers in the Mediterranean and suffocated inside freezer trucks in Austria, their cries were unheard. Their quiet crisis went unnoticed by us, the visible world. Why must we wait for problems to become crisis before we take action? I give you another example, Ebola. This horrible disease has killed thousands of populations of people in rural Africa since the 1970s. It was ignored. It was neglected until Ebola crossed the deserts and the oceans. It reached capital cities. Then it was exported to Europe and to North America. Only then did we see a collective global response. Today, over 11,000 children, women, and men have died from the recent Ebola outbreak. The unfortunate thing is that we human beings as a species are remarkably short-sighted. We delay taking action when things would be relatively easy and inexpensive to fix. We wait until the situation has become a crisis. And our topic today is about hunger and poverty. And what I just said can be said for hunger. What I don't understand in my almost 40 years professional experience is why we ignore realities until a problem becomes a crisis. Why? Has the age-old adage, prevention is better than cure, has it lost its meaning, its significance? From my perspective, the fact that 795 million people go to bed hungry every night is not really a success for those who say we cut down the number from 1.9 billion in 1990 to less than 800 million in 2014. I think the fact that 795 million people, children, women, and men, still go to bed hungry, it's not just a tragedy. I believe it is a travesty. It is a travesty because we already grow enough food for every child, for every woman, and for every man to eat adequately and nutritiously on Earth. And this is a fact. It is a travesty because millions of children are stunted by undernutrition, and their lives are blighted forever. Because of collective greed, indifference, complacency, and inaction of governments, of individuals, of leaders. It is a travesty because all of this can be prevented. So this evening, I hope to impress upon you that it is only through a focus on the invisible and the forgotten world that we will ever achieve global food and nutrition security. Because their problem is our problem, and I will explain. There is no way we will be able to achieve global food security, nor the sustainable development goals that were just adopted last month, if our rural space remain backward and underdeveloped. They will remain a blight on nations, no matter how advanced they may be. 2015 stands out as a record year for meetings. These meetings and the growing consensus on development priorities signal that the international community has a desire to solve the world's problems, and I hope so. But I believe the time has now come for us to go beyond words, go beyond speeches and statements and declarations. We should go beyond meetings and reports, and we should go beyond commitments and pledges. We know what to do, because we already know what works and we know what does not work. I believe, put very simply, what we need is action, not meetings, not conferences, not reports. We need action, sustained evidence-based action. And we must be held accountable for delivering tangible and verifiable results. Ladies and gentlemen, it will seem to me that we already have the answer to the current and future challenges for food and nutritional security. The answer is simple. It's action. 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 So I can stop here and we can all go home. But unfortunately, not so easy. Agenda 2030, which was endorsed just last month by the member states of the United Nations, gives us the framework to do just that. It aims to eliminate poverty, inequality, hunger, undernutrition, and to tackle the impact of climate change. And all of this within a 15-year time frame. This may seem an overly ambitious goal, but we no longer have the luxury of setting modest goals and targets with longer time horizons of 25 to 50 years. So the question is, can this ambitious agenda be achieved? My answer is, why not? After all, we did it with the first Millennium Development Goal. to halve the poverty rate. And we did it 5 years ahead of the schedule. In the last 15 years, the proportion of undernourished people in the developing world has fallen by almost half, as I said before, to 795 million. Having said that, I said to my colleagues, we haven't achieved anything. As long as one child dies from hunger or malnutrition or any disease related to hunger and poverty and malnutrition, as long as one child dies, we still have not completed our job. So there's no reason why we cannot achieve the goals that we have set for ourselves, what we now call Agenda 2030. But meeting this agenda, this new agenda, it will require commitment not only by and to developing countries, but to actually transforming their rural areas. And that is key. This transformation that I'm talking about is multifaceted. It must be inclusive and sustainable. Why this specificity? Because, as I said earlier, rural areas are where most of the world's hungriest and poorest people live. 75% of all poor people live in rural areas. And they are all living mostly in developing countries. So if we're going to fight the enemy, we have to go where the enemy lives. We don't wait for the enemy to come to us. These rural areas are also where the impact of climate change is being felt most dramatically. Today we have a world population that is 7.4 billion. By 2050, it will be 9.7. Actually, this figure keeps on shifting, getting larger. A few years ago, it was 9.1 billion, projected to 2050. Now it's 9.7 billion. We seem to be growing very fast. The most important thing we have to remember, in the developing world, for the next few decades to come, the rural areas is where we grow our food. Food grows in rural areas, not in cities. I know there are those who argue about peri-urban agriculture or about urban agriculture, but I can tell you, even in the developed world, here in America, food grows in rural areas, not in capital cities. So we will need rural areas to maintain our clean water, because our watersheds start in rural areas, not in urban areas. We need rural areas to serve to provide us with clean air, not in urban areas. And we will need strong rural economies that offer decent jobs, comfortable homes, and dignified living conditions, so that the world's growing population is not forced to pack itself into cities, leaving the countryside abandoned. And people keep saying, why is it that young men migrate from rural areas to urban cities? What do you expect a youth to do when he lives in a village where there is no electricity, no running water, no job? He gets disillusioned, and so he migrates to the big cities. And the urban centers begin to swell and to bulge. And these young people become what? Highly susceptible to rhetoric, extremism. And we know what happens from there. Rural areas can provide jobs because farming systems not only feed people, they create jobs and they generate money. Today, too many of the world's rural areas are destitute. But in my decades of working in development, I have seen time and time again in places as far-flung as Bangladesh, Bolivia, Burundi, and Burkina Faso, that investing in smallholder farms can lead to economic and social gains for entire communities. On a larger scale, smallholder-led development has produced massive agricultural and economic gains in Brazil, in China, and in Vietnam. Less than 40 years ago, 1 million Chinese died from famine. That's not the case today. 35 years ago, Brazil was dependent on food aid. Vietnam, 20 to 25 years ago, was coming out of a war. This can be done elsewhere as well. In China, 200,000 small farms cultivate only 10% of the developing world's agricultural land, yet they are responsible for producing 20% of total production. Vietnam's rice farmers are mostly small producers, less than 2 hectares each. 60 to 70% of those rice farms are by smallholders, and they contribute to Vietnam today being the largest rice exporting country. Ladies and gentlemen, in my years first working as a research scientist and now as head of an international United Nations agency and international financial institution dedicated to eliminating rural poverty and hunger, I have learned much about what works and what does not work. Now, since today we are talking about challenges in establishing food and nutrition security, let me share with you what I see as the 4 biggest obstacles to creating a world where every citizen, every child, every woman, and every man can eat well enough to lead a full and active life. In doing so, I probably will not touch on topics such as climate change. I will only sweep through it, nor of youth and the crisis of unemployment with youth. I'll restrict myself to just 4 broad areas, and we can discuss further during question and answers. The first challenge, or the first obstacle, is very simple. We have to start with ourselves, and that means changing our own mindset, changing our mentality. First, we have to see farmers as people, not as poor rural people who are looking for handouts, as victims, waiting for charity. No one benefits from a culture of dependency. And I tell you, I have traveled the world in my job as president of IFAD. And the most exciting part of this job is when I travel out to communities in rural areas, whether it's Bangladesh, whether it's Nicaragua, whether it's in Burundi or Ethiopia, India, you name it. They are just like you and I. Parents and mothers are looking for the best opportunities for their children to go to school. Parents are trying to buy a 1-meter-square solar panel so the children can have electricity to study at night. They want exactly the same thing that you and I want for our children. So we have to look at their business, which is farming, as first and foremost as a business that wants to make profit. Even if they are growing just half an acre, they still want to make profit. The difference between a small farmer growing chili pepper in India and Monsanto or any other of those big multinationals is one of scale. Everybody wants to make profit. And we now know that smallholders, as a collective, are the single biggest investors in agriculture in developing countries. They invest their time, they invest labor, they invest whatever income they have on their business. And that business is farming. When you think about it, and when you analyze it, you see that the needs of smallholder farmers in developing countries are not so very different from the needs of farmers in developed countries. All farmers, large and small, rich and poor, need access to inputs. They need access to financial services. They need paved roads to get their goods to market. They need support from government. They need training in livestock and crop management to improve their capacity to manage their farms. And of course, they need secure tenure to land. And they need access to water and other resources. All farmers need institutions and organizational frameworks from which and in which they operate. No matter how small they are, whether they are communities of six families or large multinationals, they all need these things. It's basic. So getting produce to market is not a problem when you have good infrastructure. But in many parts of the developing world, the roads are not even there. Or when they are there, they are so bad that farmers are forced to sell their produce at farm gate. So of what value is it to give a farmer a new variety of corn or maize so that they can double their yields? Or give them a new breed of cattle so they can double their milk production when there's no storage facility, when there's no refrigeration to preserve the surplus? And so next year, they don't do it because it doesn't make sense. And we say they are backward. They are smart. It makes good economic sense not to invest and then lose money. Everybody wants to make profit. All farmers need processing and storage facilities for what they don't sell immediately after harvest so they can store it. They can add value to it. Otherwise, they are forced to sell at a loss. You cannot run a successful business, no matter how small, if your investment of time, labor, and money yield no dividend. This last point is very important. Now, when you consider that 20 to 40% of all food that is produced, all crop production in sub-Saharan Africa is lost because of poor processing and storage, just think how many people can be fed by 20 to 40% of crop that is lost. Not to talk about food waste in the developed world, 30% of all food that reaches the markets is wasted. Let me quickly go to my second obstacle that I want to share with you. And this I address to those of you who are interested in development. First is to remember that we can never develop a person or a country, because development is not something you do for or to people. Development is something people do for themselves. That is a very salient message. So what's our business in development? Our business is to listen, to facilitate, to catalyze, to encourage, and to support, and to create the right conditions for development to take place. Too often we measure our results and the impact of our work by how much money we have disbursed. We believe that we have done a great job because we have disbursed million dollars of funds, that we have supported 200 projects and programs, or we have 1.5 million farmers or rural populations have benefited from our work. But we never define what benefit means. But these are merely inputs or activities. How many projects, how many countries, how many participants? Tells me nothing. Our work should show evidence in the decline in childhood malnutrition. We must be able to measure the impact of our investment. It must show improvements in school attendance. It must show improvements in women's entitlement to land. And must show improvement in the health of the ecosystems themselves. As I said before, merely raising yields will not solve hunger and undernutrition. Why? You can eat potatoes 3 times a day. Hash browns for breakfast, French fries for lunch, mashed potatoes for dinner. And your belly may be full, but I can assure you, you will still remain malnourished. For my West African friends, I'll put it differently, and I'm sure you will understand. You can eat garri for breakfast, eba for lunch, and fufu for dinner. I can assure you, you will never grow tall. So helping poor farmers to diversify their farming systems and to plant household gardens is important in preventing undernutrition. Yes, we can fortify foods. We can give supplements. But what you eat is what you grow, or what you grow is what you eat. Habit begins at home. So we must connect farmers to markets so that they can sell their produce for a fair price and buy the food they cannot grow. So it's ensuring that farmers have tenure to the land they farm and access to the water they need. And to succeed, we must make sure the tools for self-development reach the hands of particularly rural women. Because we know, at least at IFAD, I know personally from my own experience in communities, when you invest in a rural man, you invest in an individual. When you invest in a rural woman, you invest in a community. And community is the bedrock for development. Women make up 43% of the agricultural workforce in Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, and South Asia. So we need to invest in them. Why? Because they are the primary caregivers in rural households, and because when they earn money, we know that they are more likely than men to spend it on food for the family and for the health of their children, as well as their education. When a man makes an extra dollar, I'm talking about rural people now, not city men and not city women. When a man makes an extra dollar, you know what he will do? He buys a new bicycle, or he puts a new roof to his new house, or in some parts of the world, he takes another wife. So we have learned from experience that if you really want to maximize your investment in rural development, invest in rural women. Now, would you believe that more than half of the improvements in malnutrition between 1970 and 1995 are attributable to the improvements in women's status and education? This is very true. But too often in rural societies, women are without rights, they have no access to credit, without permission from their husbands, and they have no rights to the land, the farm. They have little authority in their homes or in their communities. This results in higher rates of poverty for themselves and for their children. So closing the gap, the gender gap, is not just a woman's issue. It is a whole family issue. It's a whole issue for society, and it's a food security and nutrition issue. But we cannot change all of that just by telling them about it. We have to work at the community level. We have to work with community leaders themselves, even if they are men. We have to educate the women and the girls and to empower them by giving them the right capacities, giving them the right tools, with time, with patience, with perseverance, understanding. I can assure you, they will change. And I've seen it happen in places like Bangladesh, India, and many other places in Africa. The third obstacle I've identified, the third obstacle to success, is unfortunately the very human desire to hunt for a silver bullet that will solve all issues of hunger and poverty overnight. And there are many believers of this approach. But the truth is, there is no one-size-fits-all approach or vaccine that works for agriculture and food security. Not one. Micro-irrigation, for example, may work wonders in the dry lands of India, but it would be of little use in the floodplains of Malawi. Or helping farmers to buy and to raise pigs may improve food security and incomes in Honduras and Nicaragua. But I can assure you, raising pigs will be of little value in Pakistan. So, yes, research certainly has a role to play in food security for today and for the future, because it is research that has given us a variety of new tools, including, for instance, in the area of breeding, plant breeding, marker-assisted selection, marker-assisted breeding, tissue culture, embryo rescue techniques. These are simple tools of technology. But also, this technology also includes biotechnology. But biotechnology is just a tool. It's not an end in itself. Agricultural research must meet the needs of poor farmers, and that includes research into improving existing methods that are easily affordable and accessible to poor people. I believe it is time for us to revolutionize smallholder agriculture by another technology, digital technology. Ladies and gentlemen, we are in the 21st century. And don't tell me that these rural people are backward. They can't use digital technology. Go see what is happening with the penetration of mobile phones in rural areas that never even knew about a landline telephone. The e-wallet system, mobile banking, M-Pesa in Eastern Africa, rural populations and smallholders are now bankable. They can bank money. And they can get inputs through digital technology. And digital technology can speed up the education of small farmers, make connections possible, transfer information at incredible speed, build virtual societies, communities, and revolutionize farmer organizations. So it is no longer rocket science. A good example, for those of you who are familiar with it, the Ethiopian Agricultural Transformation Agency is now using this technology to create a digital soil map of the country. And many more things are coming from the Ethiopian ATA. To those of you who are research scientists, do not be afraid to think big. Dream big. But please, think small sometimes. You know, it is sometimes the smallest inventions that when they are scaled up, they have the biggest results. I'll give an example. Fertilizer microdosing technique developed by ECRISAT. The DG, David, is here. Although it was done before his time, he can take credit for it. It's his institution. ECRISAT and its partners are helping poor farmers grow more food without exploiting the soil. The technique is very simple. The average farmer in the Sahel, in West Africa, cannot buy 100 kilograms of NPK fertilizer. cannot afford it. And there are no stores that will sell them 5 kilogram bags. So they gather together and they buy 100 kilogram bags. So what do? They use a bottle cap, a simple bottle cap, any soft drink bottle cap. And they apply the fertilizer in small doses against the plant. So the technique means that even a farmer that is illiterate, she can safely and easily apply the correct amount of fertilizer. Isn't that an elegant way to solve an age-old problem? Simple technology. So it doesn't have to be one of these newest technologies that will transform the lives of rural people. Old technologies, but think about them in a small way. Another case that we saw in Tonga, the Pacific island of Tonga, you would not believe this. They had problems transporting things down the hill, up the hill. So what did we do? We introduced a simple wheelbarrow. The roads are not paved. They are bush paths. But they need to carry things to the harbor. So introducing wheelbarrows created jobs for the villagers. Simple technology is introducing a wheelbarrow in Tonga, a new technology? No, but to them it is new. So before I move on to my last and final obstacle, let me say one little thing about research. As a biological research scientist for several decades, there's one thing I have come to learn, particularly as a development practitioner. And I'll be humble to admit that biological sciences alone do not bring changes to societies. A new variety by itself will not transform the lives of villagers. The other so-called softer sciences, social sciences, policy, people's behavior, their social norms and traditions and their beliefs, these are as important as the best Nobel Prize scientific achievements. So to you, the younger generation in this audience, always remember to note down and to study and understand the social context of the people that you want to help. Do not parachute into a village with some novel great idea and think that the villages and the communities are stupid because they are not as educated as you are. Yes, they may not be as educated as you are, but I can assure you they know better than you do the social context of their environment, and they are not ignorant. You can learn from them. Madam Dean, ladies and gentlemen, my fourth and final obstacle to the world food security comes from nations that do not take ownership of their own development. And I want to dwell a little bit on this. Developing countries themselves that do not take ownership of their own development. And for me, as an African, this is the biggest obstacle in my continent. Just as development is not something we do to people or for people, decades of ineffective foreign aid for development have shown that development is not something that one nation can do for another. The impetus for development must come from within, and this means a commitment from leaders to domestic financing, to the rule of law, and to the rooting out of corruption and fiscal mismanagement. Only when these conditions are met can foreign aid have its desired impact. Consider, in sub-Saharan Africa, every year, illicit financial outflows costs $50 billion. And these same African countries import $35 billion of food. We spend $35 billion importing food. basically creating jobs for people outside the continent. That's what it is. Money that can be used to build roads, hospitals, and facilities for our citizens, providing electricity, educating, and feeding Africans. Many developing countries have immense domestic resources. Just think about the oil and the gas, the gold and the diamonds that come from Africa. In 2014, sub-Saharan Africa earned about $960 billion. $1 billion in profit from the extractive industry. What did they do with the money? Now, the World Bank and others have calculated that cumulatively, domestic resources of the developing world are at about $7 trillion. Now, compare $7 trillion with $135 or $150 billion of Overseas Development Assistance, ODA, annually. Is it ODA that is going to develop these countries, or is it the $7 trillion that we generate through domestic resources? I believe that to reduce hunger, eliminate poverty, in short, to achieve the 2030 agenda, countries themselves have to generate the resources and put their money where their mouth is. Success will be driven by better domestic resource mobilization, robust tax administration and redistribution regimes, curb on corruption, illicit financial outflows, prioritization of budgetary expenditures and investment in long-term rural development, and a solid and robust accountability framework. But for these resources to be of any value, first and foremost, we need responsible governments that invest in their own people, with transparent governance and reliable institutions. We need governments that are accountable to their people and not to their own pockets. In fact, I have said to a meeting of ministers and high officials that many of our countries in Africa do not need development assistance. What they need, and our greatest challenge to food security and nutrition, are, simply put, visionary leaders with a proud national identity and a driving motivation to harness the collective will of their people to translate it into lasting change for a better life. Ladies and gentlemen, as I've said earlier, the time has come to move beyond words and to move to action. As they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, but I know that good intentions and potential do not feed people. The good intentions of previous decades have not always translated into lasting change, but today, the will for action is greater than ever before. So with all what I've said, yes, it may look bleak, it may look hopeless, but what I witnessed last month at United Nations in New York was a dawning of a new era. There I saw the world come together as one, with commitment at the highest levels and a resounding call to action. The message was made by heads of states, by leaders of government, and by business and civil society. And that message is that our world is one world, whether rich or poor, young or old, from the north or from the south, we are all in this together. We either float together or we sink together. Our world is one world, so let us not miss this last opportunity. The cost of inaction, the cost of indifference, will be a devastating failure. I believe that by working together and committing to meet Agenda 2030, I believe we can overcome the obstacles to food and nutrition security and create a world where problems are addressed before they develop into a crisis. Thank you.
Thank you very much, President Nwanze, for a very impressive presentation, comprehensive, many, many ideas, many challenges. I'm going to open the floor for questions and comments from the audience, but I have a thought that I would like to share. Today, in fact, you said it's time for action. It's time for commitments. It's time for a pledge against hunger and food insecurity. I am proud, I am happy to share with you, President Nwanze, that this is our commitment. This is our pledge. Around this room, we have almost 100 students. Some of them majoring in global food security at McGill. Some of them learning step by step many of the experiences that you share with us, things that certainly no one can learn in a textbook, very difficult to share in a classroom. Our pledge is this young generation. Today, you introduce us to your son, who's also here in this room. Another member of this new generation that will join this battle against hunger and food insecurity. Today we have in this room an emeritus professor from the Faculty of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences, Professor Eugene Dornfer. Thank you very much for being with us. And he's here with his grandson. He made his way from Toronto, and his son joined McGill in this semester. And he's very interested also in the cause of global food security and the fight against hunger. This is our pledge, this is our commitment, this is our everyday action, besides the research and the outreach that our academic community practices. Thank you very much again for sharing with us your thoughts, and thank you for allowing us to be a company in these efforts and work you do. Ladies and gentlemen, the floor is open to comments, questions. We have a couple of microphones. And please go to the microphones and present your questions.
Hello, my name is Felix von Geyer. I'm a freelance sustainable development journalist. And thank you, actually, for a very good speech indeed. It's basically as good as any I've heard from the greatest. Now, what I want to actually address is this idea of action. We're, for example, going to be coming up to Paris in the climate change agreement, and you know that many of the developing countries will be looking more at what the developed countries are going to do regarding giving them funding for adaptation, mitigation, Green Climate Fund, etc., rather than actually talking about what they are going to do to actually address climate change and their adaptation, mitigation. How are we, in the whole kind of sustainable development debate, really going to foster this change when a lot of people are still stuck and entrenched in their traditional ways of thinking, both developed countries and developing countries?
Should I answer immediately?
Perhaps, yes, because okay. We don't have any. Is the microphone working? Yes.
Yes. I guess I should stand up. I feel much better. That's okay. Your question actually is, you're asking me to look into a crystal ball and say how they're going to achieve this tangible result in COP21 in Paris in December. But I think there are many issues on the table in Paris. There's the issue of our ability to raise $100 billion every year, which is the target that we set for ourselves a few years ago. I believe since that target was set later this summer, we're still at about $70 billion for the first 2 years. So we haven't even been able to achieve $100 billion. Like I say, my position is very, maybe I'm naive. It's not a question anymore of who caused the problem. We have all contributed to the problem of climate change. Every one of us, developed countries and developing countries. Right now, we should be asking ourselves, what can I do to mitigate? What can I do to help poor people to adapt to the impact of climate change? I'm not saying who done it, because that would not lead us anywhere. The same arguments have stalled the Doha round of negotiations, trade negotiations. But I think what is going to be different with Paris is that 2015 marks a landmark, it's a watershed year for all of us. First, you had the Addis Ababa Third International Conference, Financing for Development. And we saw in New York last month, at the summit, commitment of governments. 17 goals were identified. I've forgotten how many targets. The whole range of development issues, including climate change, I think was SDG 13, maybe. But a lot of it runs through the fabric of, to achieve SDG 2, you have to be conscious of climate. To achieve SDG 2, you have to practice climate-smart agriculture. So it's everybody's business. And I hope those who are going to be negotiating will be looking at it from that perspective. If we work together, we will most possibly we will be able to float together. If we work against ourselves, we're going to sink together. It's as clear as that. So I hope that our leaders and negotiators recognize that problem. We should not wait until the situation gets so bad where we have no possibility of redressing it. The cost of inaction, not the cost of action, the cost of inaction can be very devastating. I think, I hope, and I pray that our leaders remember that when they negotiate in Paris. That's my answer. Otherwise, frankly, I don't have a crystal ball and I couldn't tell you how either side is going to behave. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. So I just had a quick question as to your thoughts about the effects of the TPP on food insecurity or food security generally.
You have to tell me what is TPP.
Oh, Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Sorry?
Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Our Trans-Pacific Partnership. Yeah. Trans-Pacific?
The new agreement that was signed.
Sorry?
The new agreement that was
signed by the
Nady, you want to present your question, perhaps?
Oh, sure.
No, that's okay.
I present the question right away? Okay. I just wanted to, first of all, say thank you for a very, enlightening speech. And I just kind of focused on your what you said about the use of digital technologies mm-hmm. to kind of outreach to marginalized communities. And I just wanted to really get your thoughts on how we can kind of remove science from the ivory tower and the research that's produced by this ivory tower, and how can we make it more accessible to the people that need it the most, and how can you use social media and new, the apps, how can we develop an app to do this? I want to know what your thoughts are mm-hmm. on that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me take this one.
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah? Okay.
My thoughts on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. I'll be honest with you. My answer, I'll be very plain, I'll be very, very straightforward with you. I do not know. It's very ambitious. There are those who already think it's not doable. When you come to think about it, let me speak in general terms. The world has become really so small that any form of partnership has to be built on the basis of equality. And I tell you what I mean by equality. Equality in sense of the responsibilities of everyone involved. And I can explain further by giving you a very simple example of what you can relate to. We often say that the fingers are not equal. All fingers are not equal. So we justify inequality. Yeah, all the fingers are not equal in length, in size. That is very correct. But I know that each finger is equally as important as the other. You try it. Try to write without your index finger. Try to write without your thumb. Try to write without your middle finger. And you know what it means. So, it is respect for what everyone brings into that agreement and what everyone can get out of it. It will work for as much as we want it to work. Any agreement of any group of countries will only work as much as they want it to work. That's all I can say about that. Digital technology, I'm a firm believer of the potential of digital technology. I'll give you a good example. You just to answer your question, I'll give you a real good example. In Cambodia, we partnered with Intel Corporation. And they developed a small tablet which can be used by a local technician helping women farmers who are growing rice. And what does it do? Very simple digital tablet. The technician, who is one of the children of one of the farmers who is trained to use it, is able to go to the rice fields and just dip a probe, and it reads the salinity of the field. Or it can also tell them about the fertilizer level that they need or that they have put in it. Now the interesting thing is that farmers, using the old advice of extension officers who are pumping their rice fields with fertilizer, the technology, the instrument was able to measure and show that they were actually wasting 50% of the fertilizer. They were wasting 50% of their money. So they were overdosing the rice fields. Very simple. So you can, mobile telephone, e-banking, mobile banking, e-wallet system. So I said, yeah, dream big, but think small. Think small because you're dealing with small farmers. They are growing one hectare to half a hectare to 2 hectares. They're not going to be able to use a combine to harvest or to plow their field. And the way to do it is basically, and I can tell you, is to go to institutions or foundations or NGOs that are working in the field with communities. Take your knowledge and see how you can apply it. The example I gave you, bottle cap technology of applying fertilizer rather than broadcasting and wasting half of the bag of fertilizer. There's a whole bunch of things, and there are a lot of these corporations are looking for young people to work with them to really take these technologies and modify them and make them available to rural populations. And I believe that's how you can take all of these technologies that you refer to about ivory tower technologies.
Yes, they were developed. And Bill Gates, by the way, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, are very, really, really into this digital technology and what it can do. Farmers live kilometers and kilometers away, little hamlets here, little hamlets there, little patches of rice fields there. Now, with digital technology, they can communicate. They can participate. They can actually participate in conference calls. They can exchange information about prices and markets, whether to sell the goods today or to wait until another day, which buyer is offering better, more money. And this is the whole thing. Let's bring all of these technologies down to earth to the people that need them most. And the opportunities are huge. For those of you who are into IT and to all this new high-tech, tremendous opportunities. Talk to David, the DG of ECRISAT. I'm sure he can tell you what you can do working at ECRISAT as an intern. Tremendous opportunities. Please, remember, you are the future. I keep saying this to young people. My future is in the past. Your future is today and tomorrow. You are the leaders of tomorrow. Thank goodness you chose the right prime minister. He's young. That's the future, isn't it?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Do we have time for
a couple? Yeah, yeah, I'm fine.
We have still time for two more brief questions, please, okay, from the audience.
Thank you very much. I'm Christopher. Thank you for the presentation. I want to ask this question because I don't know if it's the right term I'm using, but I know that there are two categories of farmers, the political farmers who sits in the government house. They don't own any land, but when it comes to disbursing money, they collect the money. Then we have the actual farmers who own the land. They use the hoe, they use the wheelbarrow, everything. But when it comes to giving the money is distributed among the political farmers. So I don't know, maybe, because if we have to secure food, the money or the fund that is meant for the farming has to get to the actual farmers. So I think this is a concern, and I don't know, how is IFAD or any other food organization trying to handle this type of problem? Thank you very much.
Do we wait for the next question?
Yeah, sure.
Kisa, you want to present your question, please?
Hi, I'm Kisa. I'm a student at McGill. Thank you for your presentation, first of all. And this is back on digitization. I was wondering what your thoughts are on just the fact that perhaps laying basic infrastructure and irrigation and perhaps like transportation infrastructure is kind of the basis and more important than jumping ahead, getting ahead of ourselves and like implementing digital technology when perhaps these farmers don't even have access to electricity. Thank you.
Political farmers versus actual farmers. Well, the way IFAD operates is we provide very low, highly concessional loans to governments for projects that are carried out in rural communities. And the way we operate, and some of your faculty have been engaged in some of these projects, as the money has to be taken by government because government has to pay back the loan. But the projects are projects that are developed with government and the community in particular areas. And the funds are disbursed only for those projects. And this is why now we have country offices and we have staff in those countries that monitor, that supervise, and assess use of funds. Where the problem is where government's funds, government's own funds that they can play with, as you say, those who are political farmers. But this is why I'm calling for accounts, for transparency, for good governance. And we know one of the biggest problems that we have, at least in my continent, is corruption. But it can be stamped out. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the success rate of the previous minister
for agriculture in Nigeria, who is now the president of the African Development Bank. Fertilizers, actually before him, the Ministry of Agriculture was basically a fertilizer dealer. They imported fertilizer, and the fertilizers were supposed to go to farmers, but fertilizer was bought by big business, and as you say, political farmers. And this was going on, it's been going on for 50 years. In 90 days, Minister Adesina broke that corrupt practice. Government or the ministry went out of the business of buying and distributing fertilizers. A census was carried out. Farmers were identified. They had their numbers. And through the e-wallet system, 90% of the fertilizers that were bought in 90 days, 90% were reaching poor farmers in their districts. It can be done. It takes leadership. It takes commitment from the political elite to do it. So it can be done. Look at Ethiopia. I mean, in the 80s, it was a hopeless case. Banned aid. Today, Ethiopia is one of the fastest growing economies in Africa, in the world, actually. Transformed completely. Infrastructure, rural areas, roads. Today, Ethiopia is the largest producer of honey, second largest horticultural industry, fourth largest country exporting flowers, cut flowers, and many other things. Largest heads of cattle, livestock, Ethiopia. So it can be done. It takes basically that is my fourth challenge. The biggest challenge for me, the biggest obstacle to transforming agriculture in Africa and parts of South Asia is basically a political transformation, a change in mindset by policymakers. Well, you know, the Green Revolution that swept through Asia and Latin America in the 60s and 70s was basically based on plant breeding, new crop varieties, inputs, fertilizer, irrigation, herbicides. It was very clear. It was very successful, but it also had its downside: pollution, degradation, salinity of fields, and so on and so forth. It had a downside. I believe that the new green revolution that was going to take place in Africa and elsewhere is going to be everything put together: digital technology, infrastructure, microfinance, inclusive financial systems, and so on, all of them. Little by little, we're going to get there. It's not an either-or. You can as well ask me the question, well, what is the future of agriculture in Africa? Is it going to be large-scale? Are these small farmers going to be able to feed the world? Listen, they have been doing it for the last century. That's why we are still alive. So, and they can do it in the next century if they have access to the same things that we're talking about. It can be done. It's not an either-or. Ethiopia, I just told you, today has a digital platform where they are able to map the soils. Currently, there are 10 square kilometers, and now they're coming down. They're bringing it down the size so that farmers can be told where the soils are good, what you can grow, and many other things of the sort. You can actually have communities of farmers congregating around the platform to get information about prices. I was in the Ethiopian market exchange, what do you call it? Stock exchange. Can't remember what time this year, and I saw what they're able to do. Well, it's not like the New York Stock Exchange, but it works. And it works. So it is there. Don't be daunted by the magnitude of the challenge. That should actually drive you to say, what can I do to make this simple and doable? It's not rocket science. It's a question of how we adapt this high tech to low users, low producers. That's for me, it's as simple as that. And the opportunities are huge. So please grab it. Thank you.
Thank you once again. for sharing your experiences, your time with us. Ladies and gentlemen, there are all the questions in the audience. Unfortunately, for now, we're running out of time. Tomorrow we'll have a full day with four sessions on current and future challenges to global food security in the developed world, in the developing countries, a session by graduate students at McGill, and a panel session by the end of the day. Please join me once again in thanking President Duance for his thoughts, for his presentation, and for being with us tonight. Thank you. Dean Guidman, thank you so much for being with us as well. We'll see you tomorrow at 8. We start the second day of conference. Have a good night. Enjoy your evening. Thank you.